Greetings, my friends. Welcome to the next episode of the Mitten Mob Podcast. Jason here, joined by my buddy Alex across the pond in Germany. We're going to jump into quite a few things, but obviously we have a lot to cover with Arttober. So we're going to do that specifically. But before we do, let's check in with Alex and see how he is, man. How's things?
Hey, man. Everything is great on my end. As you said, Arttober is approaching. And when I was on my way home, like a couple hours ago, I was thinking about the previous batch we had, because obviously Arttober is leading to the grand animated batch for the Goodfellas collection. And it's funny because I remember when we had batch number 7, which was huge back then. I remember every piece was kind of handpicked. We had so many new traits. You know, we set the bar so high. And, you know, recently we had the Sirens, which, like, the collection that was completely redrawn by Daria. And we had, like, stunning one-of-ones. We had so many new traits and so awesome as well. And, you know, now we have, like, a whole Halloween series leading up to the grand animated badge. And, you know, sometimes I feel like the bar is so high right now. Like, what can we do for the next batch? Like, how can we top that? It's so crazy. But I look forward to Arttober. It's awesome. So many great artists involved. And I think the animated batch is going to be great as well. I know we've promised that batch for quite some time now. It's obviously some work to create it. But I think, you know, with all the tools we have these days, it's going to look great, and it's something different, right? Like, I don't know any collection that has animated pieces and, you know, quote unquote normal pieces as well. So yeah, another time of innovation for us. And yeah, what about you? How was your week?
It's been good, but yeah, like you said, I'm looking forward to everything that's coming up. I was busy this past week reaching out to, you know, artist after artist. I must have sent, I don't know, 150 DMs or something, like 40 artists that I reached out to, and then back and forth, and then sending templated messages to try to connect with everyone, and then negotiating deals and all that. So it was a lot of work, a lot of back and forth, but, you know, it's always worth it when you bring good people in. So that's part of it, and more than willing to pay that price. And then, of course, with this upcoming batch, we're doing something really different. You're doing it. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what you have planned for the batch and how that's going so far?
No single piece is ready yet. So still a lot of work to come. Obviously, as I said, there are many tools out there available. But as we want to provide quality, it's a lot of trial and error. And I think I might go crazy, you know, when I see the results and I have to try over and over again. I hope that at some point, you know, I kind of get used to how to use these tools and it gets easier. But yeah, obviously with AI tools and everything evolving, it's gotten easier, definitely. But every tool is different, and you need to find the best way to use it. But it's not just me, dude. Like, you definitely need to get some shout outs here as well, because you'll create maybe one or two new traits and the one of one. Looking forward to see that. And yeah, like, I think it's going to be very, very cool. But before we jump all into Arttober, let's jump a little bit into the markets as well. And I remember on Friday Spaces, you know, everyone was in a bad mood because markets went down. Now, not really, but we saw markets declining. Bitcoin went below 110. When I just checked a couple minutes ago, it climbed up to 114. I'm not sure if there are any reasons out there. One thing I read that was quite interesting, and I read that before. I never knew the reason for that, but let me see. What was it? Like, some office of statistics or something said that it will not release economic data, including the jobs report on Friday, if US government shuts down. Why the fuck does it, like, is it sometimes, you know, close to shutting down? Is it like, what's the reason for that? And did it ever happen?
Not in any meaningful way. It's just all, you know, politics is performance art, man. That's all it is. And, you know, they've done this thing where they've had spats over the budget and what should be cut or what should be added or what's going to be included and all this kind of thing. They've done this for all of my adult life. So for the last, I guess, since I started paying attention was probably like in 2000. I mean, for the last 25 years of my adult life, I've seen this nonsense go back and forth. And I mean, there was one period where, you know, like they quote unquote shut down government, but really what they did was they just laid off people who were like low level workers. And then of course, once the drama and the media attention had passed, they brought them all back and then gave them back pay. So no one was really ever out anything. It's just all show, man. It's just performance art. So I don't put too much stock in it.
Yeah, but like, okay, but just to for my understanding, so they say or they kind of threaten people that the U.S. government shuts down if they fail to. What's like the actual original reason for why they do it? Let me check. I just read it actually. Because I think October 1st is interesting here. It's like some sort of deadline. Let's see, where do we have it? Here. So a U.S. government shutdown can happen when Congress fails to pass funding legislation. So like, how the fuck can they threaten to shut down the government? Like, I think you said people never went unpaid, but that what it says or what's supposed to happen. And some, let's see, non-essential government operations pause while essential services, air traffic control continue, blah, 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 blah. Okay, yeah. So if it never really happened, it's actually, as you said, just show and bullshit.
It's total bullshit, man. It's just all, you know, performance art, like I said. Like, if I type into Grok, like, you know, how many times... in the last, I don't know, 3 decades has the government threatened to shut down, it would probably be like 100, you know, like a laundry list of 100 different times. The thing is, you know, the budget is the budget. And if you're a regular human being with bills, unless you live in my house, my wife likes to spend money we don't have. So, but if you're like a regular human with bills, you know, you spend the money that you earn and then you save what you can. And that's it, right? Like you live your life, you pay your bills, you do what you can do with what you have. But with government, they don't do it that way, right? It's all based on a bunch of random nonsense that they compute to use to give different departments different amounts of money. And the way that departments are rewarded, they're not rewarded for like saving money. They're rewarded when they spend the money. So like if you sent, let's say Department X needed $100 million or whatever, and then in the following year, when they go to do the budget again, if they didn't use all of that $100 million, then what happens is they're not able to get the same amount. They're not able to get as much. So they're encouraged to spend every single dollar that they get so that in the following year, they can actually request more money, right? And because of this, the government budgets continue to balloon and balloon and balloon and balloon. And we have this thing called a debt ceiling. And this is just all, again, just performance art, right? Like the debt ceiling is not supposed to be breached, right? But every single time this happens, there's all this drama. We're bumping up against the debt ceiling. We don't have the money to spend. All they do is they just print the money and go through the debt ceiling and raise it. They just keep raising the debt ceiling. So like, I'd be curious. I might have to type into Grok just to see how many times they've raised the debt ceiling in the last 30 years, because it's been... every time. They've never not raised it, right? It's just, they just always find an excuse to put some sort of, you know, show of drama out on the, you know, on the nightly news so that there's something for them to complain about. But yeah, it's just performance art, man. Nothing is going to come of this.
That's crazy, but that's like such an U.S. American thing to do for some reason. But we've seen worse things in U.S. politics, I think. But yeah, I saw these news when I was looking for any reasons why Bitcoin and you know other currencies climbed up. I think we saw gold reaching new all-time highs. I'm not sure if it was today or recently. And Jim Cramer says buy crypto, which is usually a top signal, but it's also funny that Michael Saylor bought, I think, around 100 bitcoins or something. It's funny that this is news, but I don't want to ask you where do you see it going in the future, because obviously you'll tell me you have no crystal ball, but I'm actually like I'm pretty happy with the movement right now. I think we could see another rise. But I mean, everyone is kind of expecting a rise towards the end of year, to the end of the year, right?
Yeah, of course. I think the idea that the 4-year cycle have been elongated is a good idea. I don't think we've seen the top, and we're not going to see the top, because chances are the Fed is going to lower rates again at their next meeting. I don't know if it'll be a 25 basis points move or a 50 basis points move, but the chances are high that they're going to lower rates again, just simply because they need to get money flowing into the economy. And in order to do that, as levered up as consumers are, I mean, they're going to have to borrow more money. Money needs to be easy to borrow. And right now, it just hasn't been, especially with interest rates being high. So they need money flowing, which means more inflation. Every loan that you take out creates more money to flow into the circulation. And of course, that drives the prices of everything up. So like you have to remember, the average person holds their, you know, basically their net worth in the house that they own or that they live in. And so in the U.S., I don't know what the average home price is right now, but I think the last time I looked, it was around $250,000 to $275,000, you know, as an average. But I mean, here in Arizona, like you can't buy a house for $250,000 unless it's just, you know, like a crappy place to live. So, I mean, you're going to spend 3 or 4 or more just to get like a good solid, you know, like middle class type home. So, you know, if your wealth is locked up in your house and you see the value of your house coming down, which is what, you know, most of us in this area have seen over the last year and a half, then that is a big red flag for anyone who has equity in their home, because now you can't borrow that equity out. So typically what the U.S. Consumer will do is they'll buy their house, they'll sit on it, they'll build some equity into it, and then when things get rough, you can borrow from your equity and pay off those debts and continue that cycle as the price of your home goes up. If the price of your home starts to come backward, then you're not able to do that because you lose equity and you're not able to borrow that out, right? And so in this particular scenario, the big danger is that the average person's equity, home equity, will continue to decline. So they have to stop that. And the only way to stop that is to create inflation, which of course makes it harder on everyone, makes it harder on business owners because wages become an issue, purchasing, you know, the necessities like food and gas become an issue. And everything starts to implode. And that's kind of where we're at in this stage of the democracy that we're in. And I don't really like calling the U.S. a democracy, but unfortunately, that is the word that we use. It's technically, it's a representative republic, and they are not the same thing. But we've fallen into this trap of thinking that we can just print money, and that's really what we're going to see happen between now and the end of the year. The net effect will be things will be more expensive. The net effect of that will be people with money will want to hold real things, so they'll want to buy up, you know, homes, gold, silver, art, gas, commodities, all of the stuff that costs more money when inflation's in the system, and now you have to include Bitcoin in that, because Bitcoin is becoming a digital store of value. So it's like real things plus Bitcoin now is kind of the story that we have to tell. And interestingly enough, coming back to our previous conversation, I did throw this in Grok real quick. And over the last 30 years, the U.S. debt ceiling, you know, the drama that you mentioned earlier, that again produces inflation every time they raise the budget and borrow more money, has been raised 20 times. So in the since 1995, they've raised the debt ceiling 20 times. So, I mean, that tells you right there, there's no commitment to any sort of, you know, fiscal responsibility. And this is why government has to be small, because it cannot be controlled. When you're spending someone else's money, you're not as apt to take care of those funds. You see this the world over. Europe is in a horrible spot. The U.S. is certainly not in much better spot, except for the fact that we have the power of the U.S. dollar, which kind of drives global economies. But that's changing. And yeah, so I fully expect crypto to continue to climb along with real things, at least until the point where demographics catch up, and that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I mean, crypto is definitely going higher.
When we speak about, you know, financial markets and, you know, money in general, I have the feeling that the majority of every population almost doesn't really have an idea how money works. And, you know, when we speak about inflation and all that stuff, and you speak about governments and you know, the fact that they just do what they want. What do you think is the reason why so little amount of people even, you know, cares about all that stuff or wants to understand all that stuff? Because if you look at what governments do sometimes, you know, some more, some less, I'd expect, you know, people to go crazy. Like, we should have like civil wars where people should try to, you know, get their rights and you know, obviously protect their money and stuff like that. And if you say that governments don't really care about spending and, you know, just take the inflation the way it comes and, you know, everyone's money gets less valuable and all that stuff, why do you think people don't care at all? Like, do you think governments want it to be complicated so that, you know, many people do not understand that kind of stuff?
I don't think it's that people don't care so much as they don't understand. And this is an education problem. So, you know, one of the things that the Trump administration harped on in their first administration and now, you know, post-Biden years now in the second administration is getting rid of the Department of Education, because the Department of Education has prevented like quality teachers from being able to go in and do their work while protecting some of the shittiest educators you've ever seen. And I use the term educator loosely. Like, I remember when I was in high school, we had this one teacher who was literally useless. Like, you would go and sit in her class and she was supposed to be teaching American civics, right? So like a, you know, like a modern government class, right? You're supposed to learn how the government works in her class. And literally we'd go in there and she would have zero lesson plans prepared for us. And we would just basically sit in a class and talk to each other. And she would yell at us if we got too loud. But other than that, we didn't do anything in her class, not one single thing, right? And this is American civics or a civics class where you're supposed to be taught, you know, the inner workings of government, right? Well, you know, she'd been a teacher for who knows how long. You know, she was grandfathered in. She couldn't be fired so long as she could fog a mirror. And at the end of the day, you know, no, nothing was going to happen to her, right? She was horrible. She was absolutely terrible. And to this day, she's probably one of the worst educators I've ever seen. But she's not the only one that I've seen who does the same thing, right? So when you have schools that are basically, especially these inner city schools where, you know, teachers are reduced to babysitters, they're not really allowed to teach. Kids aren't there to learn because they got other stuff going on. You know, maybe they're having trouble eating or maybe they're having trouble getting home without getting beat up. You know, when you have that situation, school becomes like a refuge and like a daycare center for parents who have to work. And that was never the design. So, you know, when you look back on it, no one knows anything about government because the powers that be don't want you to know anything about government. No one knows anything about money because the powers that be don't want you to know anything about money. You know, if you asked any of these people about the food guide pyramid that we were taught, you know, when I was like 8 years old, every one of them could tell you that what it looks like, because the powers that be wanted you to know what the food pyramid looked like and they wanted you to buy bread and sugar. You know, and so that was what we got taught, you know. But if they taught you about finance and banking and inflation and Austrian economics, you know, then there would be a lot less stupid people in the world when it comes to money, and they wouldn't be able to rip you off, you know. So like when you think this through, when you have a top-down system, especially the ones that you have in federal governments and state governments, where administrators get compensated not based on performance, but just based on the fact that they're there, then you create bad outcomes, right? It's just like Charlie Munger said, you know, like, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcomes. If these people were actually held accountable for producing quality outcomes, you would see much better teachers coming in and much better outcomes on the other end, because they wouldn't have their jobs if they didn't. And, you know, organizations like the Department of Education prevented like shitty teachers from being removed on numerous occasions. And this is just horrible. Absolutely horrible. And I mean, I can speak from experience because my degree is in mathematics education, and I did my practicum in local high schools, and I did go into schools and teach. And it's just not, you know, it's not what it should be for a group of people who are, you know, committed to learning or committed to teaching. That isn't the scenario. So, you know, looking back on it, the whole system is set up to keep you stupid and to prepare you to show up on time and basically leave on time, and that's about it. You know, learn how to read and write. I think George Carlin, what was it, George Carlin, the famous comedian before he died, he said, government wants people just smart enough to run the machines and just dumb enough to accept the ever increasingly shitty, you know, like pay and like circumstances that they put on them, right? Like, so they want you just smart enough to run the machines and just dumb enough to never question everything. And that's basically how I describe school. It's pretty spot on.
Is it actually required in the United States to, you know, to go to university in order to become a teacher, or can anyone do it?
You're supposed to have a degree in teaching, and then you have to also take you have to also take a like a separate exam to earn a teaching certificate. So the pathway is normally, you know, middle school, high school, university, or college with a degree that has an emphasis on education. And then after that, you go into a school and you have a 6-week practicum where you work with another teacher. And then you have to take a test mm-hmm. to certify yourself and all this other kind of stuff. So they have all these different pathways. But the problem is, like, when you go in as a young student, they always pair you with a good teacher. You know, they always show you their best, you know. So you rarely ever see the worst that the system has to offer. But the cool thing is, like, if you get with the right person, they'll tell you, you know, this is a top-down system. You basically have zero control. You have to teach what you're taught. Or what they tell you to teach, and you're not going to be able to change the system, right? So you just basically, it's like if you go into that role, it's like, okay, well, this is how it is, and you're basically committing your life to this. And so for a smart person, like I went in there, I'm like, there's no way in hell I am going to live my life doing this. This is garbage. It's top down. There's zero innovation, and there's no room to change anything. So screw this, right? The only way to do it is to have your own school, like set up a private school. There's a woman in the UK who actually did this. And it's really interesting between what's happening in the UK and the US. We have two very different underclasses. In the US, we have a majority black underclass. And then in the UK, we have a majority white underclass. And they both have similar properties, similar value systems, if you could call it a value system at all, and similar sort of outcomes, right? And in the UK, there's a woman, I forget her name, I'm gonna have to look it up, but there's a guy in the US who does the same thing, his name's Jeffrey Canada. And basically what they've done is they've created their own school system where when you come in, we're not gonna give two shits about your home life. You know, your home life is irrelevant. We don't care about that. If you want to be here, you have to be committed to learning. And they create really high expectations of the students, and they make the classes difficult, and they challenge them, and they push them. And the rates of, like, completion of these courses from, like, Jeffrey Canada and, geez, I wish I could remember this other lady's name. She's amazing. Jeffrey Canada and this other lady in the UK are very similar. They'll take kids from these underprivileged neighborhoods, poor kids, kids with, you know, all kinds of crazy circumstances, and they put them in these environments and they perform like crazy because that is the expectation. In the standard public school, that's not the expectation. So it that's the difference, right? Like it's you either perform or you get the fuck out versus, oh, can you fog a mirror and show up today and take attendance? Okay, well, great. Well, you have your job and here's your crappy little paycheck for the rest of your life.
Yeah, like it's definitely impressive, like what the right environment can do to you. But I was just wondering, you know, because sometimes in, I don't know, US sitcoms, for example, I saw you always have that scenario where, I don't know, some fat delivery driver suddenly gets unemployed and, you know, finds a job as like a substitute teacher or something. And I always felt like, what the fuck, that is possible. But if you actually need a degree, that's definitely good news.
Well, substitute teaching is not teaching, just FYI. That's a totally different thing. Like, you could have somebody's mom come in and be a substitute teacher because all...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, all they're doing is babysitting, basically. Like, if you have some experience with kids or with teaching, it's beneficial. But there aren't really any, like, hard and fast rules on who can be a substitute teacher, you know? So, and especially if there's a lack... Let's say, for example, you have a teacher who's out and maybe there aren't very many official substitutes available. They'll just bring anyone in to, like, you know, kind of cover the class if they have even the most remote of training with kids or with education or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, that's crazy. Because it's like, I don't know, I feel like you should at least try to make a lesson meaningful, you know, and try to you know, teach them anything at least. But yeah, if you have a lack of teachers or people get sick or whatever, and you can just bring anyone in, it's, I'm not sure, this is probably not happening on like college or whatever, like on high schools, or is it actually for the older kids as well?
You mean in terms of like substitutes or just general?
Yeah, because I get that if you have like a junior high or like elementary school, that these pupils need like a substitute teacher in order to get babysitted so they don't kill themselves. But yeah, I don't know, man. For high schools, like, just like, you know, like drop that lesson and then don't you know, do that. And yeah, I don't know. It's like, I was just wondering when I saw that, and I felt like these people are, because, you know, obviously in the TV shows they're supposed to teach something, and I felt like, okay, this might be a daily thing in the United States, and they stay there for a month and then try to teach classes.
No. Substitutes are usually very, very short term, and if it's going to be a long term thing, they'll do their best to get a qualified teacher in there, right? You know, like if you have a teacher that's pregnant and has to give birth and then she's off for who knows how long, they'll bring someone in to like finish out her semester or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's a different thing from having a substitute teacher. It's just meant to be there to cover a sick day or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny, actually, because some people might not know, but I usually upload the podcasts and, you know, think of a title and everything. And sometimes when I can't remember what we spoke about, I just scroll through the episode. And, you know, tomorrow when I upload it, I'll get to like the substitute teacher thing. And I'm like, oh, what's going to be the title for this episode? Like, what the fuck? It's like a crypto NFT podcast. And we talk about substitute teachers and everything. It's funny.
Yeah, for sure.
But let's jump a little bit into NFTs, and it's today. I was almost shocked when I saw mainstream media speak about an NFT launch. I'm not sure if you heard about it, because I didn't. But did you hear about the Hyper NFT launch from Hyperliquid? They dropped a series of 4,600 pieces of a collection called Hyper, obviously. And it's, let's see, like, it made crazy numbers. It's launched on the Hyperliquid EVM chain, made 45 million in trading volume within 24 hours, floor price up to 68,000. It was just funny because the title was actually, "Are Hyper NFTs the comeback the crypto scene needs right now?" And yeah, I don't know if you've checked out the collection. I think it's cats, actually. I saw these on OpenSea. They look okay art-wise. They don't look bad, but it's funny, like how such a hype mint can still exist these days. You know, because obviously, this is probably going to, you know, lose 90% of its value within a month, and you still get these degens, or you still have these degens in the space to buy that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but these are designed for that, right? These are just like IPOs, right? Like company goes public, everybody buys a stock, and then the stock pulls way back, right? And the hope is that, you know, once the stock pulls back, that there's a long tail of growth that's coming, right? So anytime you have something like these like drops that are really promoted heavily from a marketing standpoint to a media standpoint, you know this is engineered. It's not organic, first of all. But second of all, they're not buying the NFTs, they're buying the business. So like, what's the underlying business, right, is the question. And if the underlying business supports, you think of it this way, like 4,600 shares of stock at 68,000, that's really not a lot of money when you compare, you know, like a Starbucks that has millions of shares that trade for $50 or whatever, right? So it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's like a smaller number. You're basically buying stock in whatever this particular thing is going to be. And it's acting as a surrogate for like a traditional market, which makes perfect sense. So yeah, I mean, it obviously will pull back, drastically after the hype subsides. But then the hope is, if you're an investor, that your long tail growth is going to be there. And who knows, maybe it is. I haven't really looked too closely at the business. I don't care about the NFTs, because in something like this, I would only be looking at what are the business possibilities for what's actually happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, because when I saw that that collection for the first time, I immediately thought about the Pudgy Penguins, because obviously they built a pretty good brand around, you know, these NFTs, even though I never understood why they, you know, marketed their toys so much, because obviously NFT holders are not the target audience for these toys. And this is what I thought when I saw these cats, because this is something similar, in my opinion. This is something that could be a toy, you know, in a Walmart or wherever, like a plushy little toy. And I don't know. Like, I always wondered, like, why do Pudgy Penguins work so good as a brand, even though the target audience as NFT holders, who are probably not under 18, and probably not parents, like, how does that work together? Do you think Pudgy Penguins are some sort of standalone brand that can like work without the NFT collection?
No, not really. I mean, I think basically like the brand that we're building, and the brand that Pudgy's building, the brand that OK Bears is building, like, ultimately it's all going to come down to what is the IP worth, and it's up to us to create value and to drive value with the IP, right? So I don't know what Hyperliquid's business is. Like, I think it's a new layer one, right? And so for me, like, if I'm looking at a new layer one, I'm completely uninterested. I couldn't give two shits, because there's no need for another layer one, right? And like, the Hyperliquid drop, I think, was an airdrop, if I remember correctly. So it's like people got airdropped these pieces that like the floor price went through the roof. Mm-hmm. And kudos, like, awesome. Like, hope you were one of them and did well, you know, like, kudos. Like, I want everybody to do well. But at the end of the day, like, do we need another layer one? No, we don't. We've got layer ones that do everything already. So like, the long-term prospects for something like Hyperliquid they're not good. It's just that simple. It's just not good. So if it can do something that Solana can't do, or ETH can't do, or Bitcoin can't do, tell me what that is. Because I don't think it exists. You know, so again, this might just be my ignorance. But at the end of the day, anytime I hear the words new layer one, I'm immediately out. I don't give a shit. Because all of the use cases for chain itself has been covered. So the question now becomes is, what can we use the chain for? What can be built on the chain? And so far, I've not seen anything come off of a new layer one that couldn't be built on an existing layer one. Does that make sense? So like, if that's the case, then there is no long-term value, and I'm not interested in speculating, so I don't care. If they want to airdrop me a piece and send me $64,000, I'll take it. You know, I'm not gonna whine and moan. you know, and kudos to everyone that, you know, had that happen. I love you. I hope you do well with it, but the long-term prospects are not good. So, you know, that's kind of how I look at those types of things.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. I mean, I think it's the first ever blockchain that launched its own NFT, right? Like, I mean, if Solana, the Solana Foundation came tomorrow and were like, hey, we are going to have a Solana NFT, like, that would go crazy as well. So, yeah, not sure what the purpose is. Obviously, a lot of liquidity gets drained from the space here, because I think it's like Genesis. What did it say? Like, who got the NFTs? Some Genesis holders or users or whatever.
It's always people who use the token, you know, the most, basically, or who've interacted with the chain the most. It's always the way it is, right? So they probably went through, ran a routine, like counted up wallets who had the token that they dropped last year and then have interacted on the chain. It's always the same stuff, right? Like, there's nothing new here. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, hopefully you get your money, which is fantastic, but that you move it to something that's not going to zero. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's not doing anything new, as far as I can tell. Like, I could be wrong, but as far as I can tell, it's not doing anything new.
Yeah, man. Maybe it does have like a super utility, unique that you haven't heard of, but
yeah, it's possible.
It's most likely, not that way. So I'll monitor it. I'll give you an update next week, and we'll see how it does, how the collection does. But let's jump a little bit into Artober. We touched on it in the at the very beginning of the episode. We will have a series of mints with 10 different artists, all leading up to the grand animated batch mint. And I know many people are wondering which artists are going to participate. I know that Mark is very curious about it. So I'll drop a little alpha here, because we have Paul Charles on board. He is one of the artists we've wanted to collaborate for quite some time now. And I love his art. I know that many holders of us hold pieces from him as well. And you know what's interesting is, like, I have seen all the art from all these people. Obviously, we have some people participating who have already done stuff for us. But, you know, giving them, when we have an artist incubator drop, they can be fully creative with what they create. Like, they can do whatever they want. And, you know, to some degree, you know what to expect when you know their, you know, art style and everything. But, you know, giving them the Halloween theme, I'd love to see a Paul Charles piece in like Halloween style. I have no idea what to expect. And this is actually so cool, because everyone is creating a themed piece. And as I said, like, there are so many great artists, and I'm so looking forward to what they create, right? Like, you can tell us who you're looking like forward to most. Like, who are you most excited about? I know everyone is great, but is there a particular participant where you feel like this piece, like, it's very exciting for me?
Not yet. I think I'm gonna hold out my sort of judgment on what I'm looking forward to seeing, because the truth is, I think we're going to get a lot of different pieces from what people would customarily mm-hmm. do. So, you know, what they might do for their particular usual work is probably going to be different, because it's going to be influenced by like something happening in the fall, whether it's Halloween or something, you know, something fall related or whatever. So, you know, or something cultural to them, right? So I'm holding out hope that there's going to be something I've not seen before, and that's probably what I'm going to be most drawn to. So I'm just looking forward to minting everything, and then like pulling it all side by side, and getting the story of each piece, because that's really when it starts to speak to me. But yeah, I mean, it's cool that we've got some new people that we've not worked with before. Like, Paul Charles, of course, mm-hmm. is somebody that we've been asked about. I think Masson's pieces are really interesting, because she does a lot of neons in her pieces. So I'm curious if she's going to incorporate that into some of the Halloween stuff. But yeah, I mean, the truth is, like, when you have something like this, odds are we're going to get something very different from what the artist normally would do. So I'm just going to wait and see what they put out, you know?
Absolutely. And I actually, what I love is that every artist has some sort of different approach. I mean, Let's see. Who do we have? It might not be the biggest surprise for people that Maria is also a participant. And if you, I don't know if you've checked her DMs already, but she is actually, she gave us a she gave us a description of what she wants to create. So we get an idea of what she wants to do, which is amazing. Like, I love the idea she has. But there are also some other artists who are like, when we agreed on doing something together and we were like, you know, everything was settled and they were like, all right, man, I'll prepare it and send it over. And you have no idea what they're going to do, right? So it's actually so cool that everyone is like, you know, having a different approach, and some people want to discuss it with us. Some people are confident that they will deliver a great thing. And as I said, we have some artists in there we've never cooperated with. And I'm totally excited what's going to be the result. And I want it to be as diverse as possible art-wise. You said it, Masan has a very unique art style as well. Paul Charles has, Maria, and all the other ones too. So I think the run is going to be pretty amazing. And I can say that even though I haven't seen the art yet. And then, of course, we will have the Goodfellas art style and the animated batch. Man, as I said in the very beginning, it's hard to top October 2025 in the future, right?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's it's one of those things, you know, like it's... it's always fun to like see what the result of your work is, because you know, like if you do anything for a period of time, it just becomes monotonous and boring. You know, like I started a cut like two weeks and one day ago, so like I'm 15 days into a 30-pound cut, right? And it's so boring, like every day eating the same food and just dealing with the same hunger, and it just gets so old, right? But then at the end, when you like look at yourself in the mirror and you see like the definition in your body, it's like, okay, wow, that's why I did it. You know, that makes it all worthwhile. It's kind of the same thing here. It's like DM after DM, you know, communication after communication, contract after contract. It's all the same shit. It gets really old and boring, but it's a necessary part of creating the end result. So when the end result happens, that to me is the reward, right? So regardless of what the art is that we get, I know the art is going to be good artwork. So I'm not worried about that. What I'm more focused on is like getting the end result to be the best end result possible, because that's what lights me up, you know? So that's kind of how I think about it. It's like, okay, we're in the trenches right now. You know, we're fighting the good fight to make this thing become a reality. And then once it becomes a reality, it's like, now I can breathe. Now I can look back and I can see these things and I can like digest them and I can, you know, enjoy them. Right. And there's like 5 minutes off and then we're in November starting all over again. So, so there you go.
Yeah. I mean, we made like pretty great sketches for November as well. But you were pretty much on point, because the moment I enjoy what we do, or one of the moments I really enjoy what we do, is when it's January and I usually make a post with all the achievements we had last year. And, you know, looking at this year, we obviously had some great drops, especially the recent Artist Incubator drop with the surprise pieces, the Sirens, obviously Artoba now. And I see myself sitting there in January and, you know, thinking about all the stuff we did in 2025. And this is like when it gets real, when I, you know, see all the work that has been done. And obviously when you do that in the moment right now, you know, you mentioned the boredom, it kind of gets like, it's like copy paste a lot of, you know, reaching out to artists, speaking to them, typing in prompts, doing posts and everything. And you see like the full beauty when it's all done, right? And when you see people enjoying the drops and everything. So yeah, man, absolutely. Like this is, obviously, for the long term, it's like a diet. As you made a pretty good comparison, right? Like you'll enjoy your 6-pack, 8-pack probably in December.
Exactly. Yeah. But until then, it's just all boring. It's, you know, it's chicken breast and vegetables, you know. So what can you do?
You can do a cheat week, a cheat day every week, like other people, like getting the cookies in on Sundays.
No, you really can't do that if you want to make it happen, because one day can blow your macros. Actually, 5 minutes in the pantry can blow your macros.
Yeah, if you go crazy, definitely. If you go crazy,
for sure.
It can, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. So I think we dropped some pretty cool alpha for everyone listening. And as we said, we look forward to October. I think we covered it today. Oh, I feel like we should definitely try to... Oh, we can't, man. It's like, what do we do? What do we do spaces-wise in October? Because obviously, I'd love to speak to everyone in person, but... as we have a mint every day, what do we do about it? Will we have daily spaces is the question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll have to come up with something there for sure. It'll be something we've never done before. So we're a bit in uncharted territory and we'll have to, I don't know. Mm-hmm. We'll just have to take a step and, you know, it's like Rumi says, right? When you walk the path appears. So we'll just let the path appear before us.
Beautiful, beautiful words. So yeah, let's stick with it. Let's call it quits here for today. And I think, as I said, people got some pretty nice information. And I look forward to prepare everything for October for the animated batch, of course. Getting the paperwork done is never a party, but it needs to be done, obviously, in order to provide IP rights to everyone. And yeah. I look forward to spaces on Friday. We'll definitely dive deeper into October. Until Friday, we should have the final lineup, right?
Yeah, for sure. The goal is to have everybody finalized this week. I think we're pretty much full. I haven't had a chance this morning to go back through all the DMs that I shot off this past week and over the weekend. But yeah, I think we're pretty well close to having a full lineup, which is pretty awesome. And that means like we've already negotiated, you know, pricing and this and that and the other thing, because obviously we have to pay the artists. So we want to make sure that we can afford the artists and still get good work. And we should all have all that settled out this week. So hopefully by Friday we'll have a complete list.
Yep. Awesome. So we look forward to see you guys on Spaces on Friday as well. We will keep pushing out all the information you need. So check out X, check on Discord, of course, daily. Kudos to Baddies NFT, who acquired a boss. Welcome to the boss table. Always great to have new people. And well, who else? I think Miss Jen Shaw bought a couple more pieces. I think Mark is on a pretty good way to collect all the numbers he needs. Oh, we will, of course, start opening the swap wallet, the distribution wallet for swaps in October. So stay tuned for that. And yeah, this should be it. Hope everyone has a great week and we see you guys on Friday. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys.